Welcome to Breaking Down Patriarchy. I'm Amy McPhee Olivest. I just finished the book, When Women Were Priests, Women's Leadership in the Early Church and the Scandal of Their Subordination in the Rise of Christianity by Karen Jo Torgerson. And we're going to start today's episode with a quote from that book. Quote, "Women's leadership in Christianity is a dramatic and complex story, one in which the radical preaching of Jesus and deeply held beliefs about gender sometimes melded and sometimes clashed. Jesus challenged the social conventions of his day. He addressed women as equals, gave honor and recognition to children, championed the poor and the outcast, ate and mingled with people across all class and gender lines, and with bold rhetoric, attacked the social bonds that held together the patriarchal family. When Jesus gathered disciples around him to carry his message to the world, women were prominent in the group. Mary Magdalene, Mary of Bethany, and Mary his mother are women whose names survived the retelling of the Christian story in the language and literary conventions of Roman patriarchal society. Paul's letters reflect an early Christian world in which women were well-known evangelists, apostles, leaders of congregations, and bearers of prophetic authority." End quote. So my question is, what the heck happened? And to answer this question, I am thrilled to welcome scholar and author of this book, Karen Jo Torgerson. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you very much.
I'm so excited to have you here. And as usual, I will introduce you with your professional biography first, just quickly, and then I'll ask you to introduce yourself a little more personally afterwards. Karen Jo Torgerson is a professor emerita of religion at Claremont Graduate University. Her research interests include constructions of gender and sexuality in early Christianity, authority and institutionalization in the early churches, hermeneutics and rhetoric in late antiquity, and comparative study of Greek and Latin patristic traditions. At Claremont, Torgerson founded an MA and PhD program in women's studies and religion in 1990 and collaborated with Jean Schrodel in political science to design an MA in applied women's studies in 1995. Torgerson taught and developed graduate courses on gender, religion, and transnational feminism. So that's just a very brief kind of tip of the iceberg intro, Karen, and I'd love it if you could introduce yourself by telling us where you're from and some things that brought you to the work that you've done in your life.
That may have been the most difficult assignment you gave me to put that together, but as I did, I realized I can see where the connections are, and so I'll try to tell it in a way that illuminates that. The main issue was my childhood. I have a very unusual childhood. My parents had a farm in the country in Salem, owned a printing shop, were leading an ordinary life, and in 1952, they dropped out, long before the rush, and sold everything. And we leisurely drove across the country sightseeing. In the 50s, 66, we ended up in Florida, bought a sailboat, sailed in the Bahama Islands for a while. All of that was grand. Then we went to briefly living in Costa Rica and Guatemala, and then settling finally in the southern part of Mexico in a town called Oaxaca, where I was off and on between ages 7 and 12. So my background has a very powerful cross-cultural dimension to it, and it's that dimension, I think, that shaped me into the kind of scholar I was later to become. While I was living in Mexico, our parents sent us to Mexican school, and we sat in Spanish-speaking classrooms until we could understand Spanish. And that's how I learned Spanish. And the experiences there in those years, one of the most illuminatory, the story I like to tell the most, is probably around the age of 8 or 9, I'm visiting a colonial church called Our Lady of the Sorrows. And it's a church to which a lot of the indigenous people come that go all the way back to pre-Hispanic traditions, the Zapotecs there. And so it was also a colonial church. So it was dripping with gold and filled with figures of saints. And I was an evangelical Protestant, so I knew that this was all wrong, that this was a very wrong form of Christianity. But I remember sitting in front, and I watched the indigenous people come in and make their prayers, be in their spiritual moment with the saints. And the openness of the child is what I had for seeing. And I remember realizing, oh my, they really encountered God here. And then I had to revise everything that I was thinking about dripping gold, hit a church, and saints. And it's not issues that I solved intellectually. That would come later. But it was the clash of those different paradigms and countering always difference. And then as a child, listening for that deepest truth in things that a child sees before we see the world through a dogmatic lens, which, of course, as an academic, I was able to develop to a high degree later on. But I always went back to that moment because I realized that almost every academic interest and pursuit, from violence against women to multi-religious to colonial encounter, all of that I can trace back to those years in Oaxaca. And that's what I saw when I visited that church again. So that's an echo that I think you will hear strongly through my approach to the question, when women were priests, or were they really, as thoughts of people put in as they read the title. My college education was at Wheaton College. I wanted to go back to Mexico as a medical doctor, so I did pre-med. I was pretty good in biology, so I ended up majoring in chemistry. And as a result, my grades weren't good enough to get into medical school. So that was off. I got married on graduation weekend, and my husband was a philosophy student and going on for his PhD in philosophy at Claremont, actually. And so he said, well, what are you going to do? And I thought, I don't know. Of course, I knew that what you do, you support the guy who's going to graduate school by working some job like a secretary. But he said, you know, you should really think about graduate school yourself, which I didn't. And I thought, well, okay. He said, well, what would you study? And so I thought about it. And I have to study something I really cared about, because you have to care about it the rest of your life. So I think I'd like to study Christianity, early Christianity. And that's how I set out on this degree. So when I got to Claremont, I gradually enrolled in classes and then degree programs and did early Christianity, got into the PhD program, and I studied under a professor from Germany. And he was teaching the Fathers of the Church, and he was a fairly eminent scholar in that field. And one morning when I went to the mailbox in the little mountain town called Mount Baldy, there was an air form there that invited me to become an assistant of his at the University of Göttingen in Germany, teach and finish my dissertation. It was an incredible offer, but I had to be able to speak German and study in German.
That's not a small detail.
No, and I had passed my German reading exam when I was a full-time secretary putting my way through graduate school. So I'd only memorized 1,000 flashcards that I had on my desk. So I didn't even know grammar. So that was a challenge.
But I did it.
Oh, my goodness. I was 5 years there. And I learned immensely a lot. I mean, to be participating in the study of religion in Germany, that was the Mecca for our field in that decade. And it was an amazing experience. So
I have a question. Did your husband come with you then? Did he pick up and come to Germany? Like, how did that work?
Yes. Well, that worked because he was writing his dissertation on Karl Barth.
Oh,
as you're a theologian. And so basically I'd offered him a 5-year fellowship to write his dissertation.
Fabulous.
For the small price of learning to cook.
I love that.
So it worked out. It worked out really well. So I got my degree and attended conferences and gave papers and became, because of the tremendous opportunities I had, a fairly well-recognized scholar, because your genealogy is what counts in Europe, not so much what you've published, but who you've studied under. And so that was a great asset for me. I wrote my dissertation on Origen of Alexandria, a city in Egypt, and he was the first Christian theologian. First philosopher to actually do a systematic version of Christian ideas. When I got back to the States, and through my connections in Europe, I got a job immediately. I gave a paper at a conference on, I was interested in the organizational forms of early Christianity, so I was starting to think and write on those, and then I was interested some in women. And when I finished giving that paper, it was the first time I'd given a paper in the States. I had several publishers show up and want to know if there was a book length version of what I was doing. And I thought, publish or perish. All right, I'm going to go into a new field. I'm going to go into the field of women's studies in early Christianity. And so I changed my direction. And what I was hitting was the beginning of that controversy over the ordination of women. And as I listened in on that, all of those who were opposed to women's ordination were citing not just the Bible, but mostly they were citing the church fathers, the theology of the fathers.
What year would this have been, Karen? And was this a controversy over women's ordination in the Catholic Church, or were there Protestant denominations that were talking about it too? Was this throughout Christianity? I don't know that I'm familiar with like this faith.
Right. I realize there's a generation between us. Oh, that makes sense. I need to explain that. In the 1980s, women were for the first time being admitted to theological schools to study religion. And in the U.S., a PhD in religion was very problematic because secular universities didn't want to get involved in simply catechisms. And so what that meant was there were no women scholars. Of theology, right. And so when the movement began, it came out of the women's movement, the movement for women's ordination. That's why it shows up in the 80s, because that movement is just getting strong. And it's across denominations. It's women from every denomination. What the publishers told me when I talked to them, they said, the public is so hungry, the women in the public are so hungry for any information about women, liberal, conservative, whatever, it doesn't matter. There's just a huge hunger to know. And so that's why I got that kind of response from publishers, because that's what was happening in popular culture. And it was also going on in Europe. I mean, I know about Germany and other places as well. So that was the backdrop. And I had then, for the first time, tools. And other women did too. I could do Greek. I could do Latin. I knew the church fathers. So that's what made it such a powerful time, because it was a convergence between academic women and women in churches, women in society, women who felt like they had a calling to some larger form of service within religion that was continuously suppressed. So that was the environment.
I see. Wow, that must have been really exciting.
It was very exciting. And it was very contentious. It was the resistance was huge, as you can imagine, because it was, against tradition, against paradigms, and against the location of power, at that time. And so you can get beat up pretty badly in that process. And so it took real communities of women to stand fast, as we were doing this work. So that's the background of my own education and experience that shapes how I've come to the questions that I started to try and answer in the book When Women Were Priests.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, I'll just add one more topic really quickly, because as you and I were getting to know each other, and I knew you were at Claremont, we mentioned in our conversation that I come from an LDS background, and I said, oh yeah, there's a Mormon studies at Claremont, right? And can you tell us just what you told me? Tell the listeners what you told me.
I feel like I'm coming out of the closet. Well, what I told you was that, yes, I knew. I had started it myself. So
exactly.
I was dean of the School of Religion at the time, and it was after the politics, the crisis of 2011. And so we were dealing with religious conflict and religious tension, and we were an academic university. What were we going to do about it? And so we decided we needed to be more than a place where you go off and study esoteric things, that we needed to be a university where the various religious traditions, not just Christianity and Judaism, which we were normally, were taught, and where those religions engaged each other. And we needed to be a place that members of those religious communities could call a home and could find their tradition in conversation with other traditions. And in that process, one of my women's studies and religion students, who was a Mormon, said, well, why don't we do a chair in Mormon studies and a council in Mormon studies? And the more I thought about it, I thought, yeah, she's right. Let's go. And so she and I set to, and eventually that's where we ended up.
I think it's one of only two Mormon studies programs in the United States. Is that right? Was it the first?
It was the first.
Well, I really appreciate it. I know several Mormon feminists who were either educated or have taught or with connections to Claremont, and that's, I really appreciate that, Karen. That's meaningful to me personally. And it's nice because there's a lot now that I don't have to explain about myself to you. You're like, oh, again, yes, you've known lots of Mormons. So, yeah. Well, that was a fabulous introduction, Karen. Thank you so much. And I'm really excited to dig into your book. I learned so much from this book and really highly recommend it to listeners. And I think maybe a good place to start would be kind of the backdrop. And so I thought we could start with the time of Jesus himself. So if you could kind of acquaint us with who Jesus's women followers were and then how their stories were recorded or weren't recorded.
All right. That's a great place to start. And I gave some thought to that as a category, that very early part when it's Jesus and his disciples is in the first century. So much of our material comes from the second century. And I have a piece that I have used before, Luke 8:1-3. And Luke begins by saying, Jesus was traveling in this area, and Jesus was there, and the 12 disciples, and there were some women with him. And so that evokes an image. There you see Jesus, and then you see around him a cluster of hardy working men, carpenters and fishermen, following him, and then a little bit off in the distance, you see a cluster of women. And not only that, but Luke gives an extensive introduction to this class of women by saying these were women who demons had been cast out of and who had been healed. So he's already defined these women. They're morally a bit questionable, but they have received benefits from Jesus, and they're there. So, okay, so that's where we start. Now, what I want to do is take that scriptural piece as an introduction to how do you read? How do you read a text? And the way that we've been taught to read the Bible is like reading a law book. You know, what are we supposed to do? And I came to it now as a historian. I want to know the context. You know, I have all kinds of questions. Who's the writer, and what's the writer's perspective, and why, and what are all the politics, you know, behind this? And so that question opens up some interesting counter views. So the women are Mary of Magdalene, the wife of Herod's steward, a woman called Susanna, and the King James reads, and they ministered to him from their substance. What they were is they were women of higher social classes than the disciples. And that seems pretty common in early Christianity, that women were especially attracted, and especially women from the higher social classes. So what that meant was, for example, with the wife of Herod's steward, is that she had connections all the way to the top of the government. So if Jesus got into trouble with the police or with authorities, there was a woman there who had the backdoor channels and could take care of the problem and would take care of the problem. These are women who had resources, financial resources. The story that just precedes is the woman with the alabaster ointment who anointed Jesus' feet. And it was such a costly ointment, and that indicates her social class. And she performs this ritual and prophetic act. Okay, so when you look a bit sideways at the context and ask more questions, what emerges is women, not only women being present, but women being in highly significant roles, really influential, and influential for reasons we would understand. Social wealth, social status, social mobility that these women had in traveling. So they were, if you've done any fundraising, you know, they're your main members of this group, and you're most concerned about their needs and keeping them committed to the cause. They're important in those ways. So that's, I wanted to just pick an example of the stories we inherit, and then other ways of reading, which we learn in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the beginning, but that's an illustration, and we can go on and then say, all right, so what's happening with these descriptions, the demons cast out, with the woman with the ointment? There is always a sexual innuendo behind these. Prostitute gives you that. The woman with the ointment, that's implied in, you know, she's out in public. Where's her husband? What's she doing here? She doesn't belong. And that we'll talk about later, but that organization of society into public and private, so that women who were active in the public sphere were most vulnerable to accusations and innuendos against their sexual behavior. And that's one of the ways then that you can disempower women, and those designations you'll find especially in Luke. Most of the women are described as influential and important, but with some flaws. It undermines their authority.
That's really interesting. I think it's so interesting that you say, too, if you look sideways at it, or if you have the training of a historian to kind of read between the lines of what's there, then you can see these, then like a whole different image emerges. But yes, what we inherit, at least what I inherited from just reading the words without any of that academic training, was just what you talk about in the book, where you get these accounts written by the men. And like in Luke, you point out that Luke reports that the women delivered their message to the rest of the disciples at one point, but Luke writes, but these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them. It's like right there where the men are like, oh my gosh, so annoying, rolling their eyes. And then you say too that Paul talks about how when Paul is giving the account that Jesus had come back and he was appearing to people, that Paul says he appeared to Peter, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time. Last of all, he appeared to me. And you point out Paul is omitting that the very first person that Jesus appeared to was Mary. And that's attested in all four Gospels. And Paul just completely neglects that part. He's like, let's see, who did he appear to? This guy, 500 other guys, and then me. like it's there were even women there. And so just how it was recorded is so androcentric. It's just so masculine. But so I appreciate the expertise that you bring to this and say, like, well, actually, there's also this whole other kind of subtext that you can unearth. So this is fabulous. So let's move on to Mary Magdalene. Maybe we can zoom in on Mary. And we have done a whole episode on Mary Magdalene, and we could do that again right now. But maybe we'll just spend a minute on Mary Magdalene and how she was recorded and what her significance was really quick.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you just asked somebody who's been reading the New Testament, you know, who's like the most significant woman? It'd be her. It'd be easy. It's the name you heard the most. Who's the most significant man? It's Peter. And it's the male name you hear the most. I mean, you can just tell where the influence is, you know, in that simple kind of test. Well, so with Mary Magdalene, we have a woman who has been a witness of the resurrection, the first one, who was commissioned by Jesus himself to carry the message of his resurrection, the message of his gospel to the brethren and to the world. So she is now designated as an apostle, one who is sent, and she is a teacher. So this is the figure that we have from the New Testament writings and variations between the various writers for their particular agendas. In the second century, late second century, we also have a gospel of Mary. So the traditions around Mary were so strong that there is even a gospel attributed to her and focuses on her in those roles of being an apostle, of having been taught by Jesus and therefore being a teacher and being a prophet. And one of the things that I like that's so valuable for me in the Gospel of Mary is in the Gospel of Mary, you see spelled out the gender conflict, because Peter says, oh, I don't think these were Jesus' teachings. Would he talk to a woman more than he would talk to us? I don't think so. And then another apostle intervenes and says, Peter, you are always quarreling with the women. Why don't you just listen to her and we will go and do as she has said? So this is a story within the Gospel of Mary that illuminates the social context, that is the rivalry between Peter as a recognized leader and Mary Magdalene. So obviously this group that used the Gospel of Mary felt that Mary's leadership was more important than Peter's leadership. But that there was a contest between those who favored Peter's leadership or those who favored Mary's leadership, and you see it echoed in many places. And so what I learned to see is gender was a big issue in the early community. And precisely, I think, because so many women were attracted to it and they played influential roles. And so you had a conflict, a cultural conflict around that.
Wonderful. Well, let's go to a different aspect of the gender conflict that we see. We have, you know, obviously Christianity emerging out of the Jewish tradition. And then one of the other huge pieces of the social context is the Greco-Roman tradition, right? The Romans controlled Judea at the time. And I mean, I think that the people living in that area of the world had actually been Hellenized for a long time too. So the Greek tradition had really, really influenced even devout Jewish people at the time too. So maybe we can talk about the Greco-Roman tradition and how this would have influenced the early church and how they saw gender.
That's a really important question. And the most significant piece to start with is that none of us were trained to ask that question. Who are the scholars who can ask questions about that? They're anthropologists. They study gender. They study it in a systematic way. They study it in an academic way. And then the other discipline that you'd need to know really well is sociology. Where are you going to find a sociology you know, a first century Judea or a second century Judea. So let's say two things. One is that scholars of religion were not trained at all in these ways and not able. We were not able to ask those questions. When you start looking at women, you start asking those questions, but there are no tools to answer. So what I did is I started reading anthropology and I started reading sociology because that's the only way I could have tools to answer those questions. Now, what has happened to the field, which is really exciting, is there's lots of other people like me who did the same thing. And so there's been now a whole generation of scholarship that draws on anthropology and draws on sociology and brings that into the discussion of theology and of the history of the leaders and so on. So that's where I started. And I looked specifically at the gender systems in the Mediterranean, contemporary, because it's very difficult to see anything studied historically. And just to make that connection to my own history, suddenly I was back in Mexico. And I understood the way the gender system was described because it was so much what I experienced as a girl child living in Mexico, because it's a cultural system that came from Spain. And so it connected, interestingly, to early Christianity. And that was a valuable piece of my cross-cultural growing up. So there's two significant pieces of the Greco-Roman gender system. One is the division of gender roles in terms of public male space and private female space. And so, for example, for a girl to be out without being accompanied by a man or a guardian, she was already sexually indiscreet and subject to harassment. And so the streets, in a sense, are patrolled so that women are uncomfortable there, know that they don't belong unless they have a male guardian with them. Okay, so that's the situation we have in the ancient world, the Greco-Roman world. And that excluded women already from public spaces just to be in them. And then, more importantly, it excluded them from all the realms of power. So that for women to hold office as administrator, for women to hold church office, is to be, you know, exercising a public power and therefore a male power. And the role of women was the domestic space. Now, that was a wide space. It was wider than it is for the American nuclear family. The household was the center of economics. And so it was management of both agricultural production and management of crafts production, weaving and dyeing. And women, heads of households, managed the slaves, which were the staff, and so educated, disciplined, exercised all the kinds of powers that were exercised by male leaders, but within the households. So that's the first, probably, major dimension. And the second one is the role of sexuality, and that is that male honor is defined in terms of political achievements, offices held, public acts, like we would expect. A woman's honor was her reputation for chastity. And there's lots of stories, you know, about women's chastity and how they sacrificed to prove their chastity, sacrificed their lives to prove their chastity. And so a woman's honor is her shame. So that restricted women in public roles because of the way the innuendos of sexuality would undermine their authority and their character. And they would also have little access to the roles of power. Now, women did exercise power, but they were through patronage, which was a more private role, but it was significant mode of power for them, especially women.
Yeah. And by patronage,
I remember from the book, that means kind of charity work, right? Like they would get involved with doing good in the community. Is that right? Or am I not remembering that? Okay.
That's part of it. But actually, yeah, I should explain it. Patronage was a really important, this is now sociologist, was a really important part of Greco-Roman society. And so the members of the upper classes would take under their wing people from the lower classes. So as I tell my students, you know, so you're, you know, your son needs a scholarship to be able to do his education. So you go to the patron and you say, you know, could you please? And it's a lifelong relationship. And the patron says, yes, you know, I'll fund that. And so the exchange is the client, the one who is receiving the patronage, is the one who gives honor. And it continually burnishes the reputation of the patron, is there on in an entourage whenever the patron is moving across town, then can call on these clients, come and be part of my entourage. So people see how important I am. So it's a long-term, lifetime relationship, and it's a form of redistribution of wealth, you know, because that is how you get help, how you survive, is by, you know, being a patron. And you can see it's at all social classes within the upper classes. You know, there are patrons that are more wealthy and more powerful of people who are in the lower social class. But that was a role that was not gendered.
Okay.
And women played that role as much as men did.
So they maybe should have been called matrons, but
that means something different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's not a good word for it.
Okay. So this was such an important and new concept for me. And especially what you said earlier, just a minute ago, about women's roles at home. I had, I guess, kind of associated that more with, you know, the American concept of the housewife, where they just kind of were kept indoors all the time and they only took care of their children and maybe like kind of were bored doing their embroidery, like in a Jane Austen novel or something like that. And you spend quite a bit of time talking about how women, like that was kind of a full-time job. And we have talked before on the podcast about the oikos being the root word of economy. Like, but it was households were producing, they owned farms, they were doing agriculture, selling wares. So it was household management was a big responsibility that women had. So they had a lot of authority, but it was just constrained to the home. And so that was such an important foundation for me to then understand the next piece, which was house churches. So I wonder if you can tell us about how, I guess maybe another piece that we would need to understand is how Christianity was practiced in the early days, and then why it was kind of, why it happened in the home.
Okay. I'll start in the early fourth century with Constantine. Most people know about him. He converted to Christianity, and he created the first Christian church building. And what he did is he selected the basilica. The basilica was a Roman hall, often a judgment hall. From basilicas, you know its architecture because they're modeled on this Roman model of a public building. And that expressed the power and prominence architecturally of Christianity in the Roman world in the fourth century. Up until then, there were no churches architecturally. Mm-hmm. There were no churches.
For like 300 years, you're saying, like more than 300 years, no church, no Christian churches.
Yeah, what happens is, so and I was really interested in this early period, and I did a lot of courses on early architecture, Roman architecture, and treatises on architecture, and went to excavations. I mean, it's fascinating. And then I incorporated that in my teaching. So that was really rich. So the early Christians met in, for the middle class, you know, those who could be patrons, they met in the homes of the patrons. Their homes were large enough. But Christians in the early period, they didn't belong to those classes. They were in the lower classes. And so they met in the shop If you know a little bit about Mediterranean architecture, you know, you'll have on the ground floor of a building, you'll have a shop on the street, and then living quarters behind it. That's how the working class lived. And that's the space of the house churches. They were in those spaces that people lived in, that Christians lived in. And so the group that gathered there, they would choose their leaders, and the person who was most influential was the person who owned the house, right? And who could provide more protection, and you could provide more resources, you know, for that little house church. And they would pray. The Bible was the Old Testament translated into Greek. The stories, the teachings of the gospel were spread. There were prophets who'd come through and teach. But then it was the simple process of reading, each person giving their interpretation, what they think, a shared meal. And that was the center. And that continued up through the fourth century. Now, what happens as a house church got more prosperous, then more rooms would be added. And eventually, these house churches, when they got really crowded, the owner would move somewhere else, have another house. And then that house would be exclusively used for the Christian community. It would include a baptistry in it and places for people to spend the night when they were traveling. So you see that the functions of the church were really the functions within a household. And this second stage is called the domus ecclesia, which means the house of the community, where it's exclusively used for Christian worship. So what that means is that the social world of early Christianity was domestic and therefore followed the patterns of domestic gender lines. And in the household, there's treatises, ancient treatises in Greek, and there's treatises in Latin discussing the household and the important role of the head of the household, who is the woman, you know, who's in management. As the classes got higher, it's a disgrace for a husband to involve himself in the matters of the household. The household, and the same words are used, households are ruled by the woman head of household.
That was a huge aha moment for me, just seeing that exact kind of causation that you just outlined, is that if the oikos is the realm of the woman and church was held in the household, it was in the realm of women. And you even say in the book that early Christianity almost had a reputation of being like, oh, that's a women's movement, which was like mind-blowing for me that it really had that association early on.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Celsus was a famous intellectual and very anti-Christian. He felt so strongly about it, he wrote a treatise on it. And the treatise, in his treatise, he said, these Christians, what are they? You go to one of their meetings, and what it is? It's women and peasants. That's all there is.
So interesting.
So he dismissed it. Yeah. You could dismiss it that way.
Mm-hmm. And so this led also to what you kind of flesh out and illustrate as where men and women had lots of different roles in early Christianity, and kind of to the point of your book and the title itself, is that women occupied positions of authority in the early Christian church and roles that we would never associate with women, right? Because we read the Bible and we read all of these positions like the bishops and pastors and prophets and teachers and evangelists and stuff. And at least when I hear all of those words, I picture men, 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 men. But tell us why that's not accurate, Kieran.
Well, you can see that in the household, a woman is a disciplinarian. A woman is a teacher. A woman is an organizer. And so one of the places that was fascinating for me to get information from, we already knew that widows were a separate group. They were provided for by the community. That's the social welfare part of early Christianity. And we think of it in that terms. But the widows were also an order. They were seen as part of the clergy, and especially in the texts of Eastern Christianity. And so you have the widows doing evangelizing, doing instruction for baptism, doing discipline, you know, along with teaching, and enjoying significant authority for that, doing visitations, doing healing. And that went with their social role as widow. That had a certain power in it. It wasn't just someone who was receiving welfare. And they were recognized, and there is a couple of texts that show them at the altar.
Wow. Yeah, these are things I never
learned. Clergy.
Yeah. I never learned this in Sunday school. Okay, really quickly, let's shift gears and talk about Paul, because Paul is obviously super maybe controversial, and there are passages in the New Testament from Paul that feel pretty hurtful for women. So can you tell us what he wrote and then complicate that narrative a little bit by giving us some evidence that Paul did respect women as leaders during his era?
He's just such a really fascinating figure in every way. He was crucial in the formation of a Christianity that was defining itself distinct from Judaism. So he was very influential, and he was very daring and courageous and zealous, as he himself described himself. So it was a period of evangelism. You know, Christianity was spreading really like wildfire through the region and carried by all kinds of people, women and men, and they were supportive of each other. They often met in prison in areas where Christians were being persecuted. They kept in touch. They formed a network with each other and encouraging each other and comparing notes. I mean, it's a missionary culture. If you've been exposed to one, you know what that is, and you can get the sense of the excitement and the adventure involved. So Paul had many associations, and the part that was most exciting to me, this was work that Bernadette Bruton had done, in the last chapter of Romans, Paul greets all kinds of friends and fellow missionaries from everywhere, but the ones that were in Rome were the ones that he was addressing himself to, greet this person, greet that person. So these are Romans that he met somewhere on the evangelistic trail. And there, I think, as I recall, 21 of them, and a full third are women. And I just use that, you know, because I thought, okay, that makes kind of rough sense that probably in terms of leadership, it's at least one third women.
Amazing.
You know, in these roles. And so, I mean, that became for me kind of a larger framework. And then Paul's writings to the churches are very specific, you know, to that particular community and to whatever was undermining the unity of the community. So you had communities that were debating gender, and he intervenes in those, you know, in different ways. So you have a lot of commentary in that sense of Paul on gender as it operates within a community and a particular community that was struggling. But that has to be read against the backdrop of how many of his colleagues were women. And those relationships are warm, admiring, you know, his interactions, women feel supported. So who Paul was on the road, I think, is more supportive than the Paul that has been created by church leaders and pastors who are opposed to women's leadership. And so they've made a canon, in a way, you know, of restrictions on women's roles that they've drawn from those Pauline letters. And that process of sifting and shifting and changing is particularly visible in terms of what happens with the copyists. And so my favorite story is one of the persons that Paul greets in Rome is Junia, And Andronicus and Junia, he says, he calls them foremost among the apostles. So apostles of the apostles. And that continued in that passage for several centuries, but somewhere around the 11th, 12th century, it became Junius and Andronicus. So there was a sex change operation that took place.
Oh, wow.
With the pen of a copyist who said, oh, that can't be. That must be a mistake. We'll correct it. And Bernadette Bruton, in her scholarship, documented that there is no Junius in any Roman text.
But there is a Junia.
There is a Junia.
Wow.
You know, and establish that. That's an example of several things. One is of what feminist scholarship has provided. Two, it says, light on the process of change that takes place through the simple practice of copyist. Because these texts are copied by hand up until you get to the printing press. And there's changes in everything, not just issues on gender, all kinds of theological changes that take place and so on. So these are things that the historian has to account for or can account for, or it's always more complex, you know, when you start digging.
Yeah, and I can imagine like each individual person has this document in their hands and it just would be so tempting. Sometimes I'm sure it was completely unintentional and not conscious at all. They just bring their own lens of assumptions and experience and they'll have that masculine lens on and just be like, oh, that has, you know, they'll bring it to their work unconsciously. And sometimes there may have even been like deliberate changes made of like, I think I'm just going to alter this just a touch. Anyway, that's really
now.
Okay, well, so the next, I guess, step in the chronology would be to return to that piece that you talked about before. So you have the house churches, you have almost some egalitarian structures within earlier Christianity because the house is the domain of women and Christianity is in the house. And so women are doing the evangelizing along with men. And then you brought up that with Constantine, things start to change, right? And they build a basilica and it becomes more Roman. Is that correct? Maybe we can talk about the transition to where the church started to become more male dominated.
Yeah. And that was after the question of women's leadership. That was the question that occupied me the most, that I was fascinated. Okay, what's the process? You know, how do you reconstruct the changes that took place? And we can start again with Constantine. Constantine made Christianity the state religion. And Constantine did that by getting involved in a theological controversy and inviting all the bishops from all over the Mediterranean and sending them all expense paid invitations to Nicaea for them and their entourage. And this is the first time an emperor had ever done that. And it was a tremendous honor to the Christian churches and to the bishops. All right. So that's a big change point. So I'm going to go back like one step and say, why did Constantine do that? What made Christianity such an attractive ally in running the empire? And so my answer to that question as I began exploring it is what was happening. The house churches were evolving in the first century and the second century. And by the second century and the beginning of the third century, you have the houses of the church that are just for the church alone. And you have a process of centralization taking place at the same time so that there is one leader in a house church. The leader of the house church is the patron. When you have multiple house churches in a city, now you're going to get some centralization of leadership. So there's one influential church group and one influential leader. And so you get the development of what is called the monarchical episcopate. So the bishop who had once been an apostle or a teacher or a prophet, and that had been the source of authority, now develops a judicial power. And they're actually bishops' courts on Monday. So because Christians are not, you know, are to not go into the secular courts. They're to bring grievances together. And so you have a monarchical bishop who holds court and gives justice. So that's a different kind of discipline than you had when it's a group disciplining the group.
Can I ask a question really quickly too, when you're talking about earlier, when there the each little home church would be headed by the patron, could that have been, just to be specific, could that have been the woman patron or a man patron or either one? Okay.
Sure.
So when
we know that because we have Paul's addressing women, you know, and the church that's in your house. Greet them.
Yeah.
So we know that.
But then when it changed to like the bishop, the ecclesiastical bishop, and they're over a court, could women do that role? Or is that maybe one of the tipping points
very good question. We have been looking at textual evidence, right? We've been looking at evidence that written down and copied and transferred, knowledge transferred that way. There's another form of evidence that we already have talked about was architecture. But there's material evidence as well. And so there are inscriptions, dedicatory inscriptions where, you know, something in the church has been dedicated, a gift to the church by so-and-so and so-and-so. And there are epitaphs, which are the funerary inscriptions. This is this person, husband of this person or wife of this person and so on. So in both of those contexts, they were done in the Roman world with the titles that they held, with the offices that they held. And so there has been growing evidence, now that we're paying attention to it, of women office holders that we can verify through inscriptions and epitaphs. And there are women bishops.
Wow, that's so cool.
There are women bishops, yeah.
Yeah.
And women presbyters and women priests and women deacons.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Actually, I think it's worth just pausing here because actually, as we were talking through this, I thought I need to go back and just ask this question just really explicitly. And maybe this is me coming at this from a Mormon context, too, where women still are not ordained. And there have been, you know, controversies that have come and gone. Mm-hmm. But the male leaders of the church will, you know, are sticking to this of prohibiting women's ordination. So the title of your book is just so evocative, When Women Were Priests. And so I just want to pause here and emphasize that you're saying all of these positions of leadership were held by women, including priesthood, including maybe performing even saving ordinances, including overseeing councils, standing at the front and saying, I'm in charge. It's incredible.
Yeah, there are, no question. And I'll tell you this story again because it just has so many pieces in it. Mm-hmm. All right, my editor chose the title, When Women Were Priests.
Okay.
And in the book, I describe a basilica that I had visited where there was a mosaic of four women. One of the women had a square halo, meaning that she was still alive. The others were saints. They had died. And the inscription around the woman was Episcopa Theodora, Bishop Theodora. And so he was fascinated by that. I said, let's make that the cover of the book. And so he had his assistant, who was fortunately Italian, call the church and say, you know, we have a book that we're going to publish, and we'd like to put this picture from your church on the cover, and we would like to have permission. And so the priest said, well, what's the book about? And the smart, fast-thinking Italian girl said, it's about holy women, Father. And he said, fine, that's great. Okay, so it got published. So fast forward. So I'm thinking, I won't be very welcome when I go back into that church because so a few years later, I do get back to Rome and I go into the church and a priest comes up to me. He sees I'm looking around and said, come, let me show you something. Here is a picture that an American scholar thinks is a woman bishop. And women have been coming steadily to see it. And you probably want to see it too. So I'm thinking, I'm thinking, what happened is that there's no anger over the gender stuff because this little tiny church is getting attention. And that's good. Hooray, hooray. The story's not over. So that was really fun. I come back another couple years later, and the A on bishop has been scratched. It's a mosaic, glass mosaic. It's been scratched out, like erased. And 2 years after that, I came back, and the whole mosaic had, that piece of it had been redone, and you couldn't see anything, and it said nothing.
It's
the record is gone. Biscopa Teodora.
What year would that have been?
Gosh, when was the book published? The book was published in
95 or so?
Yeah, 95. Yeah.
Oh,
so
it might have
been around 2000. But that's just, there's the whole story, right?
They're still doing that because you
hires. Yeah.
Whoa. Like that's, iconoclasty and just taking out the historical record.
Right.
In the year 2000. That's insane.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, so that shows the story tells so many different things.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. That's tragic. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it is.
Do you know how that happened? Like, I wonder if the leader of that local church chose to do that himself or if he was ordered to do it by a higher up.
I'm sure it was a higher up.
You see, because we have
his advantage of the little church. People getting reputation, you know.
But
it would be higher up.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a great bridge to get back to the story where we were too, which was at one point women were operating as leaders in the church, and then at some point it's kind of like my introduction where I'm like, what the heck happened?
Right.
What happened to create, I guess in this last portion of our conversation, we'll talk about how the church became so masculinized. And so that takes us back, I guess, to the Council of Nicaea, right, Karen?
It takes us back before that.
Okay.
Because the question I've asked about Nicaea is, why was that so beneficial to Constantine? Mm-hmm. Why did he do it?
Right.
Okay. What were the politics? So what's happening in the third century is that there are more and more members of the upper class who are converting. And they are invited to be bishops, you know, because they have connections, they have wealth, they're patrons. It's perfect. I mean, it's great. And they have served in public office. They're now in the class of people who take city administrative offices or administrative offices in the empire. So they bring with them the culture of public life and the mores and the values and the gender system that underlies it. And so you begin to get conflict over women in leadership because of this model. And then as you get closer to the fourth century and they become more and more powerful, then they really do represent a block of power. You know, if you have the bishop of a large city, you know, in your patronage, that person, that individual can command votes, authority, influence on your behalf. So it's a smart move. So the success of Christianity made it attractive for politicians like the emperor. And so you get a merger, really, between the traditions that Jesus gave and the forms of leadership that evolved first in the house churches and then borrowed more and more from public space. And that's why there's greater and greater pressure on women in leadership roles. And by the time you get to the sixth century, there's debates over whether women can sing in the choir. where the women's voices can't be heard. So you know that there's a trajectory that's followed there. And there's resistance all along the way as well.
Yeah. Well, I think this argument is very much alive even in the modern Christian church, right? I mean, we have still a debate between whether women are allowed to have authority, whether they can be ordained in certain denominations, like we talked about earlier, or even whether there should be gender equity. And I know one way of framing this is with egalitarianism versus complementarianism, which is an argument that persists today. Can you tell us a little bit about egalitarianism versus complementarianism?
Yeah, the my perspective is a perspective of what an academic and someone who is very interested in the processes of social change. So, as I told you, once we had a chair in Mormon studies, and we also had the PhD in women's studies and religion, I started getting Mormon feminists come to the program and for their education. So it was really fascinating to watch them, because what they're doing, they fully understand the character of patriarchy and the way that it operates, you know, within their own world. And they have made a fundamental decision, and some of them didn't do this, most of them did. They wanted to stay within their tradition. They felt like the challenges of feminism could mean that if I followed that, I would have to give up my tradition. And I was particularly interested in the ones who didn't, and most of them wanted to stay within the tradition. So then they began the process of, okay, how can we change? Where can we change? What are the pressure points? So I feel like we're in good hands because of those women, and I watch them in their writing. And so one of the ways they've created to expand, this is my interpretation, you know, to expand the roles for women is to evolve this theological concept of complementarianism. So that it's not a frontal attack on patriarchy, but it's a strategy for empowering women within it, expanding their roles, giving them a new voice. Like, for example, I have one of my students, a recent PhD, finished a dissertation on what was happening in the blogosphere. And it's phenomenal. I mean, these women who are doing the blogging, in a way, you know, you're doing things very similar. They're doing prophetic work, you know, they're doing theological work, they're leaders, they have followers, they have people who listen to them and are guided by what they say. I mean, these women have immense authority, and they found a way to create it. No one's baptized in them. There's no ritual by which they have been given this power, but they have created spaces. That's what this dissertation was saying. They have created spaces for women, and they've created a voice for themselves, and they've created a voice for women. So that's what I see happening in that process. There's a lot of pressure building, and I don't think that's the last station. I think that there'll be evolution beyond complementarianism. But I think that's what it does.
Well, that's a really interesting, it's really interesting to hear your take on Mormon feminism from the outside. And that actually was a really beautiful way to frame that. I hadn't thought of that, you know, women not being ordained necessarily, but finding a different avenue to exercise maybe even more authority, for sure, more authority in some ways, or they would.
Yeah.
Had they just been ordained to a traditional role as a bishop, say, within the, yeah, you know, the traditional structure. That's interesting. If we have time really quickly, could I ask you about egalitarianism versus complementarianism in the Protestant world? Like, I'm seeing a lot of people debating it right now, that there's evidence in the Bible that because of this evidence that you just talked about, that women were priests before, women had authority before. So Christianity is inherently egalitarian. Jesus established an egalitarian, you know, ethos, and that women had authority before versus complementarianism. I'm just seeing that argument a lot online still.
Yeah, that's right. And that's big among evangelicals.
Right.
Evangelical Christians. Right. And let me put it this way. When we first started this work on women's ordination, you know, back in the 80s, I thought we were looking at 200 years.
Hmm.
You know, you just knew, okay, this is the long haul. You're in it for the long haul. So I was shocked that there was so much change, you know, within the short period of time. And it's everywhere. So, for example, I work also with the Eastern churches, Eastern Orthodox churches. And some of them are now close to ordaining women deacons.
Oh, wow.
Because that's clearly an office that women held. You know, that matches tradition. So it's a return to tradition, and we've been failing, you know, in tradition. So you can see that kinds of expansion. And then, of course, in the Catholic Church, what you can see is really, I mean, the amount of visibility that women have in the church is just stunning in comparison to what it was 30, 40 years ago at every level. And the church is shorthanded. There are not enough priests, so they're going to have to do something about that. So that's really powering a lot of the change. And then you have marvelous German scholarship that's been going on for quite a while on the canons of ordination and on ordination and of women being ordained as bishops. And within that group, this is in Germany, they evidently, during World War II, when so many of the men were imprisoned or died, it was done secretly, but there was a group of women who were ordained priests so that the sacraments could continue because it was essential for the survival of the community. And so one or two of those bishops who were part of that ordination of women, you know, had the lineage and were willing to ordain women. And so a new kind of movement of ordaining Catholic women to the priesthood has emerged. And I've been to several of these ordinations. And what they do is the ordinations are done often on a river, because that makes jurisdiction ambiguous. And there are now churches that are calling these women. So I know of women here in our area who have been through the ordination process, have been called by a Catholic church, and are functioning as priests. This is within the Catholic Church. That's how it's working there. Now they get excommunicated.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, exactly. But it's still going on and it's spreading.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
So that's a kind of underground movement of women's ordination.
Interesting. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our discussion, Karen. This was so fascinating. I'm so grateful for your book, for your scholarship, for all the work that you've done in the world. Do you have any final thoughts as we wrap up?
Well, I have a final thought, which is I think what you're doing is amazing.
Oh,
I see the model that you've chosen of a podcast, you know, your use of technology that way, the social model that you've used as a discussion conversation, you know, that makes everyone feel comfortable and connected is fantastic. I feel like the way you've organized it around themes and how much you've picked up the international is just awesome. You know, so, I mean, you're an example of what I'm talking about. I'm quite encouraged. I am not discouraged.
Oh, wow. Well, I did not, listeners, for the record, I did not know she was going to say that when I asked for final thoughts. That's so kind of you, Karen. Thank you. This has just been an absolute honor and delight to meet you and to benefit from your work. So thanks again so much for everything you've done and for being here for the conversation today.
My pleasure indeed.
And And that wraps up today's episode. Before I go, I want to thank Sam Rose Preminger for our editing and production, and Aubrey Iyer for our social media. And as always, I want to thank you, listeners, for being here. Make sure to check out our YouTube channel, Breaking Down Patriarchy, which features short, super entertaining videos that were created specifically to be able to share with friends and family members. Huge thanks to Ralph Blair and Aubrey Iyer for their genius work on that series. And if you want to show your appreciation for this excellent ad-free content, the most helpful thing you can do is to forward this episode to your friends and family and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. These reviews really do help people find the podcast, and the more people listen, the greater the impact of this grassroots movement to break down the patriarchal structures in our institutions and our relationships and build egalitarian structures in their place. Thanks again for joining me, and make sure to tune in next time for another fascinating episode